Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our national health is worsening versus much of the developed world, yet we spend far more on health care per capita than other nations. Bankruptcy due to health and medical costs is common in the U.S., but rare elsewhere. 40 million Americans are without health insurance, and we're adding about 14,000 per day per recent studies. Most of the other industrialized nations have near 100% coverage. Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Outside of Anchorage, toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. Our email address is line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll be talking about the American healthcare system on Line 1, your health connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center. This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, fight the flu by washing your hands often or using a hand sanitizer, coughing into your sleeve or a tissue, and keeping sick people at home. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is the U.S. healthcare system. My guests today are Dr. Richard Monsager. He's the chief executive of Providence Alaska Medical Center and Providence Health Services Alaska, and Richard Neubauer, chief of service of internal medicine at the Alaska Native Medical Center. He's also a member of the Board of Regents and chair of the Health and Public Policy Committee of the American College of Physicians. Our phone numbers in Anchorage are familiar to you. If you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska and Anchorage, the numbers are 550-8422 and toll-free 1-800-478-8255. Also, you can email us during the next hour at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. Before we get started, I'm going to just promo next week's program as well, when we'll be talking with Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at University of Indiana College of Medicine. And he is co-author of a book called Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Health. So we'll be looking at myths about health care, and also, because he's very much involved with health care reform, we'll be looking at some myths regarding health care reform as well. Dr. Monsager and Dr. Neubauer, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start by I've started the program by pointing out three problems that keep haunting me and others when I read about it. Are these issues those things that you think are significant problems, and are there others that we should be talking about today? Either one of you.
This is Dick. One thing I'd say is that if I try and measure what would be an equitable and fair and superb healthcare system, it seems to me it would have several attributes. It would be safe. The quality of care would be top-notch. It would be accessible and available to everybody. It would be health and prevention-oriented. It would be fairly financed. It would be transparent. And it would be patient and family-centered. And by most of those attributes, I think the American health care system comes up wanting. If you're sick and have insurance and need a response, our system works really well. But on most of those other attributes, I think it has problems.
So it's not available to all?
Correct.
It's failing on quality. And the reason you would say that, because so many of us hear how good our healthcare system is.
I think it fails on quality on the prevention side, about mm-hmm. keeping people out of hospitals. Mm-hmm. The fact that in hospitals we have errors, it's not as safe as we want it to be. We drop information. We don't transfer information well across the continuum of care.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dr. Neubauer?
Yeah, I would agree with all of those things. I think to me when I hear criticisms of the current efforts to reform the system, I come back to exactly the things that you mentioned. We have care that's roughly twice as expensive as most other countries. We're failing in the quality measures, in reasonable quality measures from a population standpoint, and we fail to cover all of our citizens. So if we're spending more than everybody else, not getting good results, and not even covering everybody, I think going on with the status quo is unacceptable. I think people who say that that we have the best healthcare in the world are just frankly wrong. Most of the rest of the world has actually left us behind, and we need to change. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that seems to be an issue that, when you look into it, is disturbing, and that is that particularly the developed nations in Western Europe, Japan, in particular, Australia. I'm not going to say that all of these countries are everybody's happy with their health care, but relative to the U.S., the health of the population, the fact that you don't go bankrupt, the fact that everyone has equal access to a large percentage of the health care is distinctly different from what's happening here.
You know, there's one thing that I think Americans should be proud of, and that's that if you think about the research investment in health care, I've seen reports the United States invests up to 50% of what the whole world invests.
Right.
So from a point of view of what's new medicines, what's new technologies and so on, America really has driven a lot of the rest of the developed world. Our problem has been making that available to everybody and paying a disproportionate price for really for research that the rest of the world benefits with in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the current vernacular is that probably the research endeavor needs to include in the future things related to comparative effectiveness of different methodologies of care. And there's a lot of discussion of transitioning to that sort of research environment.
I think the other thing is our research investment has been symptomatic of Americans. We like technology. We like things that fix right now. We're much less interested as a country in slow, difficult system change kinds of things. So I don't think it should be too surprising what we've chosen to invest in. But as you say, Rich, it may not be suiting us the best for the future.
Although it now appears that the vast majority of physicians and the public all agree that something has to be done, and even congressional efforts now are we can't help but pick up the paper every day and see that things are changing, that efforts are being made to make some changes. But can the changes be done that need to be made? And maybe before I even get to that, I want to point out that these recognition of these problems are long-lasting. The American College of Physicians has had a white paper years ago talking about these specific issues. So they're just really now coming to a head, possibly because enough Americans are being hurt by the healthcare system.
Yeah, I guess I've sort of just as a citizen and observer, close observer of what's going on, coming to the conclusion that the steps that we're taking now in the current legislative environment are going to be the first steps. I think what I'd like to see happen and what I think needs to happen is that we at least come out of the current healthcare debate with a decision that we have a moral obligation to cover everybody. I think what's going to happen after that is that we're going to have very tough choices about cost control, and I'm not sure that we can have those discussions unless we bring everybody into the tent.
Yeah, I guess I would echo the same thing. That seems to me as I look at the various bills that are now the Senate and House are coalescing around, there's a fair degree of a large degree of agreement around several things. Everybody that has insurance, you shouldn't lose it if you have a pre-existing condition. You should be able to get insurance if you have pre-existing conditions. Women shouldn't pay disproportionately more for having kids. It should be pretty portable. You can change jobs. So those kinds of things I think Americans finally have come to fairly broad agreement around. The hard issues are around what's going to be done around the cost containment side.
And that, and I like to think of it as there's three people driving all these costs. There's the insurance companies or whoever's making paying the bills. There's the physicians, us, but there's also the patients, and they may not like in the past when we've tried to. Someone said, "Well, wait a minute, we're not sure we're going to pay that, and so we're going to get the cry back that we have rationing." Mm-hmm. We'll come back to some of the problems perhaps later, but I do have a caller. I want to take his call. He called in pretty quickly. I suspect he has an important question he wants to ask. Bill, you're on line one.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I like the comment, everybody under the same tent. And so far, it seems the medical industry is not in that tent. I had a friend telling me the other day again, and I've heard it before, we blame Medicare going broke and blame it on the victims when really the medical industry is pricing the product so high that Medicare can't handle it, and then we can't pay for it. And I'm just wondering when the medical industry is going to be in the tent and when people are going to ask hard questions about pricing the product, not the word cost, mm-hmm. pricing product.
Right.
And I'd like to have you ask them some questions about that.
Yeah, no, it's a very, very, very important question. I have my own thoughts about it, but I think we have some other people in the room itching to answer. Richard?
Well, I think from a physician standpoint, the major organizations representing physicians are actually in agreement that we need reform. With some dissension among the ranks, I would acknowledge the American Medical Association, of which I'm not a member personally, is in favor of reform, at least on in their policies. And the American College of Physicians, which I am a member and very active in, is in support of reform. And the surveys that have been done amongst physicians show that a majority of physicians are actually in favor of reform. When you say the medical industry, it, of course, includes much more than physicians, and there is some diversity in that. But, again, most of the organizations representing, say, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, have at least gone down on record as being in favor of reform. The problem is that they all, when it comes down to the specifics, they act as limited interest groups, and they represent their own particular interests.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, yeah. They for-profit hospitals are answerable to their shareholders first. And when you pay, had a friend, $1,000 an hour for an emergency room, you know, $20,000 to have a baby, I mean, that's the whole industry, you know, not physicians necessarily, but the hospitals and so on. And I'm just wondering where the pricing, you know, we know what we pay for a gallon of gas because there's competition or whatever, but the how it's determined what an office call costs, what a, how much to rent the operating room to have your baby, and, you know, that stuff is kind of taboo for people to talk about. You don't see anything in the media, and then you can look at seeing how much medical industry advertising is in the media. Is there a connection? I don't know.
Yeah, well, the vernacular is that that we should be emphasizing value-based purchasing. We should pay for the things that we value, and we should value the right things. We should value outcomes and the proper things that we want should take precedence over more elective things.
You know, yeah. Well, I like your bit about bringing everybody under the tent. Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for your call. Dick?
I was going to just make a little add-on comment that one of the things I'm encouraged by, assuming we get to the end game and we get a bill that is signed here this fall, getting more people inside the tent and more coverage means there will be less cost shifting. I speak these days particularly from the point of view of a hospital, and there's a lot of cost shifting or charge shifting that goes based on what the various discounted contracts are. And getting everybody in for coverage is at least a step down in that journey. The other thing, the side of the coin is, I think from our institution's perspective, we expect there will be more demanded, more and more public accountability about what do we do with the money we earn, what is done with investments at the end of the year, how much is a reasonable amount to save for the future. Those are legitimate, from our point of view as a nonprofit institution, are legitimate questions. Senator Grassley in the Senate has asked lots of questions about the nonprofit hospital world in the future. If more people are covered, what's the community benefit that hospitals offer to communities? And I really look forward. I think that's a healthy debate we should be having.
I have thought of this as all the specific things that we're concerned about are downstream results of what we elected to incentivize when we set up the current healthcare system. We decided we're going to have a free market and that people could charge what the market would bear. And a perfect example, I think, of where that's led us is Atul Gawande's article in the New Yorker called The Cost Conundrum, where he looked at healthcare costs in McAllen, Texas versus another town, El Paso, I think it was, not too far away. And some people play the game better than other people do. And I don't think it's fair to think that all physicians or all pharmaceutical companies or anybody are bad. Most of us are very good, very ethical, but the way the system is set up, it's incentivizing what we're getting is out-of-control healthcare costs.
Dr. Gawande drew superb attention to a problem that had been discussed even before his article, that there are huge regional variations in the cost of care for the same sorts of people. Mm-hmm. And I think his article both drew attention to the problem and also gave hope for a possible solution, talking about how some communities can come together in what are called accountable care organizations to bring down the cost of care by paying attention to just the problem that you're talking about, which is that you can game the system and churn charges that really don't add to the health of the population but add to your pocketbook as a provider.
Mm-hmm. Dick, any comments on that?
I was sitting here thinking about what the future might look like, because we have developed a healthcare system in this country that is premised on the idea that we want people to be incentivized to do more work. So you get physicians, hospitals, other members of the system get incentivized and paid on a per unit of work basis, not on the value to the population of the work done. We also, I think, as physicians, come out of a guild and craft training method in the Middle Ages that where I trained in Iowa City, I tend to think of those doctors that trained me as the people that knew the right thing to do. People that trained in Dartmouth, New Hampshire, look to that. So we still have a lot of regional variation that's based on who our mentors were. What I'm now hopeful about the future with better information back to providers about the variation in both in outcome and rates of doing things, that we can be on the verge of reducing some of that variation where the quality of care has been shown to not be affected by doing more, and sometimes actually is adversely affected by doing more.
One of the things that I think is very positive in the current debate is that there's been a recognition that the primary care systems in our country are broken and collapsing. And I know we've talked about that on your show before. And shifting an emphasis to good primary care, I think, is really important. The other part of that is I think there's a growing recognition that if you just pay for more widgets in the current fee-for-service system, that's not a very conducive environment for primary care. And I think Dr. Mansager is alluding to that we need to come up with different payment systems that incentivize good preventive care. And we need to start paying attention to the fact that primary care in this country has been on a downward decline for quite some time.
Some years ago, Dr. Harold Johnston and I chaired a health manpower study group for the state looking at it. What are the health physician needs in Alaska in 2020 and 2030? And one of the things I found pretty sobering and really startling was the fact that in internal medicine, of the folks coming out of residency going into general medicine and those folks choosing family medicine for their residencies, the rates have dropped more than in half in just the time period from 2000 to 2006. So if we don't incentivize folks to go into medicine as primary care providers, we're going to get the results we get, which is people are coming out of school with a lot of debts. They have a family they want to support, a house they want to buy, and they're going into specialties where they can make bigger incomes.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, there's three ways to get a hold of us, two telephone numbers. One, our local number, 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, and you can email at line1@aprn.org. Remember that you need to do that before 3 o'clock today. If you're listening after 8 o'clock, you're listening to a taped program. How do physicians feel about health care reform? What can we say we know? I know that 60% of physicians favor a public option, not a public option alone, but the inclusion of a public. What else can we say about physicians?
Well, I find it heartening that in the work I've done for the ACP, for the American College of Physicians, that we've taken, I think, a very pro stance towards the fact that we need reform. And we've been upfront in terms of developing policies that are, I think, very forward-thinking. And we've had a very, very limited number of physicians who are saying no to that stance within our membership. Mm-hmm. And we represent about 127,000 doctors, students, and so on in internal medicine, second largest medical society in the professional society in the country. And our membership is pretty much with us. There are a few very vocal people who are saying no to those stances, but really it's very few. I think one of the things about the public option, which maybe we'll talk about, is that it really depends on what the public option is in its specifics about how it's going to affect or not affect the future of healthcare in the country. I know that one criticism of some of the current things that are coming out of the House is that it's going to cover very few people, and those people are going to be the ones who are most sick and really can't get coverage otherwise. And if a public option is only covering say 2% of the nation's people, it's not going to have a great impact, and that is a problem. So it really depends on what the public option is as to how much of an importance it's going to play.
What I hear over at Providence, I think I would echo some of what Dr. Nubar said, with a couple of differences here in Anchorage, and that is that there's great anxiety that a Medicare rate structure is going to be imposed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As most people listening to this show know, Medicare rates for providers in this city and this state have been really problematic for reimbursement and covering costs. That said, the Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Physicians, the American Academy of Family Practice, all at a national level, are all on board saying we need to have access and coverage for everybody. People shouldn't have to go into bankruptcy because of medical costs. You ought to be able to get what you need if you really need it, and you ought to be able to get preventive care. I think there's been broad agreement at the professional society level across all of those organizations. Is there anxiety about the unknown? Absolutely. The details are what's going to determine how this goes forward.
Yeah, the interesting – it is very – there's many interesting things. The Medicare rates in Anchorage in Alaska – here, Medicare is one of the worst payers, if not the worst payer. Most parts of the country, Medicare is the best payer. But the interesting thing about that is that Medicare for physicians is looked at adversely, whether it's the best or the worst payer, for different reasons. It's looked at as kind of the 800-pound gorilla that either sets everybody else's prices low or it's the worst payer, which you shun because you can make more money seeing other patients. I think the one thing about healthcare reform within organized medicine is that when in our discussions we're talking about whether we support or don't support healthcare reform, I think most of the responses I hear are that you know, even if it really falls short in a lot of different areas, we feel that the status quo is unacceptable, that reform has to happen, that it's going to be the first steps in a larger process that's going to take years to unfold in its entirety. And if we choose the status quo, if we choose not to reform, even if we're not reforming as much as we should, we're going to really come up short and be in a world of hurt later on.
I'm going to take a short break and we'll come back. I have a caller I want, and I want to address these issues about Medicare and some of the concerns that others may have, particularly with the federal government becoming involved in a public option. But right now, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. You can reach us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. You can email at line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and talk with Dr. Richard Monsager of Providence Hospital Health and Services in Alaska, where he is chief executive, and Richard Neubauer of the Alaska Native Center, and also the Board of Regents of the American College of Physicians, as well as chair of the Health and Public Policy Committee for that organization. You're on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence Imaging Center, providing early detection of breast cancer with digital screening mammography, and technologists with more than 170 years of combined experience. Information at provimaging.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. My guests today are Dr. Richard Monsager of Providence Hospital and Dr. Richard Neubauer of the Alaska Native Medical Center. You can email your questions and comments to us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org, or give us a call between now and just before 3 o'clock locally at 550-8422. And if you're outside of Anchorage, our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. And please remember, if you're listening after 8 o'clock tonight, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. Robert, let's take your phone call. You're on line one. What can we do for you? Oops, my... I'm sorry. Robert, we're trying to get to you. Hang on just a second. While we're waiting, let's talk about the Medicare issue a little bit more. What's the specific issues? Why is it just specific Alaska? How does that dovetail with the concerns others may have about how the government may not be the right person to be making a lot of our health care decisions?
Well, I'm not sure that the latter statement is true. I think that that if you look overall government-paid-for medical care in this country accounts for roughly 40% of all the care delivered. So those who say keep the government out of our health care, I think they've been in the health care business for a long time. Between the VA and the various parts, Medicare, Medicaid. Medicaid is a federal program. Mm-hmm. The federal government is deeply involved in health care. So, mm-hmm. And it will be forever and ever. Mm-hmm. That'll never go away. So I think it's erroneous to say that it's not involved. Medicare, I think from my perspective, the problem with Medicare is it acts like an insurance company in the worst sense of the word. It tries to get the lowest premiums for its people, regardless of the adverse demographic effects on the profession caused. And it's particularly a problem for primary care because in the rigid fee-for-service environment, if you're seeing patients in an office just for a fee, it's very difficult to make a good living. And in fact, actually, In Anchorage, where the costs of overhead and so on are high for providers, some people, especially those in primary care, can actually lose money if they see too many of those kind of patients. So Medicare has ignored, and CMS, the federal agency that oversees this, has ignored the powerful demographic effect that the Medicare program has on the provider community.
You know, as I've watched from the various organizations I've worked for over the years, I've thought some about, I wish I could imagine a Medicare world where there was some local state ability to fine-tune it for the local state. I compare Medicaid in our state that is a reasonably good payer for, and I think pretty fair payer for docs, for hospitals, for other parts of the system. And the state has done it as a part of public policy to make sure we have access to care distributed throughout the state. Medicare, being a large kind of one-size-fits-all kind of reimbursement system, has had more trouble. Now, you go to other parts of the country, Medicaid is viewed as anathema, the kind of discussion we have in our state about Medicare. You go to some other states, you'll find people talking about Medicaid the same way. So clearly there's been some state will involved in our state that Medicaid isn't – if you have Medicaid coverage, most people can get care and can get seen.
Mm-hmm. Robert, are you with us now?
Yes, sir.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'd like to talk to the doctor. You know, I've been in Anchorage for 30 years, and I've been always going to Providence. Two broken legs, coma for a couple of weeks. I love Providence. But one time, I got hurt, and the police cuffed me and threw me in the ambulance, cost Medicare $600 plus my copay. And I didn't think that was quite right. Where it says always help, not hurt. Comment.
Well, I'm trying to figure out if I can interpret what the question is in there.
Why did the police handcuff me and throw me in the ambulance? I said I'll take a cab.
Well, that's an interesting question that happened on the obviously it happened outside the hospital. From a hospital perspective, you show up, we're going to take care of you regardless of what the means are you get there, whether it's
Providence is always taking care of me, but yeah. I got hurt on an off the job injury. I got assaulted, and the police handcuffed me and put me in the ambulance, and it cost Medicare $600 plus my copay.
Yeah, Robert, I wish I could. I don't know how to address that particular issue, so we're going to move on. Thanks for your call.
Okay, sure, buddy.
All righty. Why is it that Medicare continues to not try to adjust to a fair reimbursement for physicians that are, why is it? Why can't people... Why can't somebody see that nobody wants to see Medicare patients, nobody wants to go into professions where they see Medicare patients, and that we're going to lose all that? Why is somebody not changing that?
I guess I would challenge just a little bit of what you said, because I think if you're a surgeon or a proceduralist that can do a lot of procedures, I think I haven't heard that people don't get access if you have Medicare coverage. It's more on the primary care side where Medicare access.
Right. So, I think that's an important differential in the whole discussion, which we really haven't talked about at this point. But it seems like – all right, so let's just limit the question to primary care. Why hasn't there been some efforts – well, maybe there have been efforts. Why hasn't it changed?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very complicated and technical question. But part of it has to do with the way that Medicare, CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid have measured the access question. And they have very poor means, actually, of measuring access. And they lump together access as any access. So in other words, if you go to a subspecialist, that's the same thing to them as going to a primary care doctor. It's not, I think, the same, but for their purposes, they don't have robust ways of measuring. The other is that it's a very complicated system. There are means of providing professional input to the decisions, and There's things called the ROC, which is a relative value update committee that that looks at these things, but it's skewed towards surgeons and procedurists for various technical reasons. The other point that I think is important is, you know, we may look at the Medicare system as a problem for providers and hospitals and so on, but if you poll people who have Medicare, the mantra has been, keep the government out of my Medicare, which when I first heard it, I thought this is ridiculous and people don't understand. But I think they actually do understand. Even though it's a government program, you're not going to keep the government out of it. What they're really saying is, I have my coverage, and even though it may be dysfunctional in some ways, it's still I have coverage, and I'm terribly afraid that any intervention by the government to reform is going to take away something of what I have.
There was an attempt and has continued to be attempts using some a technical term called relative value units in trying to equilibrate what's the value of my time as a pediatrician when I spend 20 minutes in office evaluating a child with an ear infection with the time that an ophthalmologist spends removing a cataract. What's the value of that thinking process and that technical skill? And for better or worse, the system we've got has put more value on that procedure that requires technical skill and thinking than on the office-based visit that's mostly based on a thinking skill. And as long as we're now in what's perceived as a zero-sum game, that the only way you give primary care more is take it away from other people, we're going to be stuck. Mm-hmm. I hope that there will be a decision to say we as a country need to invest more in primary care. Then maybe we can unstick this argument a little.
Yeah, and I would agree with that totally. I think the and that's mentioned earlier, that until we get away from a strict fee-for-service payment environment, I think it's going to be very difficult to do that. I mean, if you sum all of the money spent on thinking-type codes within the system, it's a huge amount of money. And so relatively small changes have been shunned in that kind of system. The other thing that happens is as more procedures are added in a zero-sum game, the pie is split more towards towards procedures, because the amount of procedures that are done grow. You can't grow different kinds of thinking about the problem. We have relatively small numbers of codes for thinking and a burgeoning number of codes for procedures.
And since they're paid more, they're paid better, there's more incentive to develop more of those and less to develop the things that are not paid for, which is preventive health care and psychosocial services.
Right.
And that, right?
Right. And the other thing is that I think just to move the discussion along in that, I think the best idea I've seen is that we have some kind of management fee, that we need to acknowledge that there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work that goes into primary care. And it needs to be paid for separately from just when the patient is with you in the room.
Doug, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I have a question. How is it that other countries seem to work with single-payer health care, but it doesn't seem to work in our country?
Well, my first answer is I don't think we've tried it, but let's see what the other guests have to say.
I've often wondered what would have happened after World War II if we had followed any of the European countries' models instead of our model as to where we would be now 60 years later. And it's interesting, I think, in the European countries, in Japan and Taiwan and Australia, when you go and look, there aren't that many that only have one payer. There are several that have a variety of government pay, insurance kind of models. But the single biggest difference is that everybody's in.
Yeah,
that we don't have exclusions.
Right. And you keep hearing that all these other countries are socialized, and that's not true. The only truly socialized country that I'm aware of and that I'm thinking about would be England. And the other countries, many of them have health insurance, independent health insurance companies and so forth. So.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that we're stuck with the history of our country, that we have a pluralistic system right mm-hmm. now that excludes a lot of people. Other countries have a variety of solutions. Some have single payers. Some have pluralistic systems. There's no reason we can't cover everybody with a pluralistic system, but we have to change from what we have now to something different.
As long as we continue trying to cost shift, it's not my bill, it's somebody else's bill, then we continue to do what we do today.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Great question. And, I mean, it really is, I think, at the heart of a lot of what many of us are thinking about is why are we so different, and is what we're doing better? And, boy, when you really look at it, we're not doing better. We're doing worse than everybody else, which raises the question, should we be doing more like everybody else is doing? Jonathan, you're on line one.
Hey, thanks for talking about this afternoon. I hear you guys talking a lot about Medicare and reimbursement rates and the need to adjust payments to reflect the actual costs here on the ground. And I'm wondering, from your guys' perspective, you know, there was recently a bill that was supposed to reach the floor in which we would have had some real debate on changing the reimbursement rates, you know, making sure that doctors get more as we move along. And I went to Senator Murkowski's town hall, and she identified that as being a major need to fix Medicare before we get too far down the road with other things. But she voted against it, and I'm wondering why you think that you know, changing reimbursement rates wouldn't be a solution to part of the problems that we have here, or if there is a way we can actually fix this.
I think we're both looking at each other trying to figure out what to say, so I'll jump in at the risk of putting my foot in my mouth. The particular bill got, once it became very partisan, Democrats lining up in favor, as I understand it, and Republicans lining up in opposition, it became really difficult to find a way forward. I don't understand the particulars of this bill very well. I've only read some of the media accounts. I guess I'm still cautiously hopeful that in the construct of the larger reform debate, there will be some direction to how Medicare is directed to deal with primary care reimbursement at some more accelerated rate increase than the rest of the, at least the physician reimbursement system. I think we will know when we get to the end whether that's true or not.
Yeah, I think just looking at the whole healthcare debate so far and watching what's happened in the House and the Senate, this is an excellent civics lesson. What has to happen just from a technical standpoint is you have to get a bill out of the Senate and a bill out of the House, and then it can go to a reconciliation committee that can try and meld it into one bill. I don't think anybody knows what that bill will be. So one of the more encouraging things that has happened in the debate is that it has been recognized that primary care needs to change and get more support. And at least some of the bills have some really robust things in it for primary care. The biggest question in my mind is, will it be enough to attract the best and the brightest students and young physicians into the field of primary care? And I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. I suspect that the current things that are being discussed are not going to be enough, and that we're going to have further discussions. And my hope is that Congress and the government in general will be looking carefully and monitoring what happens after the current reform efforts. And if it's not enough to make primary care what it needs to be, that other things will be done.
Okay. Thanks very much. Appreciate your call. Mark, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I've had a problem that I haven't been able to pay a physician additional money in order to get them to see me. I had an occasion where I had an elective procedure, and I got Medicare, and I called, and I made the appointment, and then the receptionist for the physician asked about my insurance, and I explained it was Medicare, and she said, well, the doctor won't be able to see you for a number of months because he limits, you know, the number of Medicare patients they have. So I understand that, and I said, well, how about if I pay the difference. Mm-hmm. And she said that's not allowed. That would be illegal. Mm-hmm. Can you explain why that would be illegal?
I'll give it a stab. I mean, you're asking the underpinnings of why that is the case. And I think the reason for it is that the Medicare system was designed to provide care for all people who are in a certain age group. And the feeling was when the legislation was set up is that if those who can pay can easily opt out of that system and just pay more, that it would basically leave behind those who are less fortunate. So in that sense, it's a socialistic system that the founders, the people who originated the system, said, gee, we need to have everybody in this group together. If we exclude those who are fortunate to have the means to pay more, opt out of it easily, then it's going to leave the others in the dust. There are, by the way, ways that you can opt out of Medicare as a physician, and there are some very fortunate people who are extremely wealthy who can opt out of it as patients, although it's not easy to do that.
You know, I would just add that in my thinking, the legal principle is a social justice issue that all elders that have Medicare, whether you can afford to pay extra or not, get treated the same. On the other hand, in terms of our particular Alaska problems, again, back to my point, if there was some way that Alaska could wrestle with for some Alaska-specific options, it seems to me there should be some way that we could allow people that do have secondary insurance to contribute if that would help with access. And I don't know whether we'll see it or not.
It's a shame because it limits physicians that I can see because yeah. Not everybody, you know, accepts and of course my internal medicine doctor, you know, is sorry that they have to. I mean, she looks after me, but she wishes that I wasn't as old as I am.
There's a larger problem here, too, and that is that if you look at the number of people coming out of training programs who are going into primary care fields to care for adults, it's anemic. Mm-hmm. And even if we solve this problem locally with some Alaska-specific solution, we've had a very, very poor influx of primary care providers to the state, and that's a national problem. Nationally, those who are interested in going into primary care coming out of training programs are a very small number right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your answer.
Thanks for your call. Other problems that have been identified that we've with our healthcare system we've touched on in some ways is that there's a lot of unnecessary call to care, unequal care that Dr. Neubauer, you've addressed, that our overhead for healthcare is exorbitant compared to other countries. Just the fact that we have multiple different kinds of healthcare insurers requires a huge amount of overhead, and then there's fraud and abuse. I'm just thinking of one particular paper that identifies those as sources of big costs. And I want to remind our listeners that it's very well known that we spend about twice as much as the nearest country in healthcare per capita. So these are important issues. How are we going to be addressing that? How are the current things on the table, legislation, going to address this? And are we addressing it in the current debate?
There was a recent article published by the president of the Kaiser Family Foundation in which he talked about the fact that American medicine has been a seesaw between folks who believe in regulation, i.e. government does this and prescribes that and so on, and the other end of the teeter is free market folks, is let the market work, and we go back and forth. He argues that maybe we're starting to enter into a third area where systems changes now are gaining policy credence and getting more play at the table. So the unnecessary test issue, I guess I think we're on the verge now of more data that looks at geographic variation, gives feedback to providers, gives feedback to hospitals about how we do compared to other places in the country. I know in our own healthcare system, our hospitals being compared on a numerous number of fronts to how we do on quality and value to many other healthcare systems. And I think that information is on the verge now of coming back to physicians at an individual level. 20 years in the future, I would imagine that as we reduce variation, some of this unnecessary cost will have been not as bad anyhow. Mm-hmm. I don't think in Alaska that fraud is a major problem. This will always be a place where people, when they see a lot of money, there will be some people that will try and take a run at doing things illegally, and you always have to be vigilant, and auditors always have to be at the table. But I think in our case, it's going to be more, can we reduce unnecessary tests, and can we get people access earlier so they're not getting the expensive care if it could have been addressed earlier?
Well, one of the first things that I did when I assumed the chairmanship of the ACP Health and Public Policy Committee is fostered through a paper that was in the works on cost control, and there were about 50 separate items on the list, including things under the control of physicians, things under the control of patients, and things under the control of the health industry, including pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, et cetera. It's a multifaceted problem. I totally agree that the term fraud and abuse for physicians is kind of an unfortunate one, and I think the thing that really is a big player is unnecessary tests. And the Gawande article that we talked about earlier identifies, I think, very well that can be sort of hidden in these regional variations in the cost of care. But I think when we do get to a serious discussion of cost control, it's going to have to involve everybody, including the public. It's totally unacceptable to have obesity rates like we have in this country, and that's leading to an epidemic of diabetes that's going to sap away a huge amount of healthcare resources if we don't address it, et cetera.
So we all have a part. I like to think of it. We've all had a part to play in where we are, and we're all going to have to be willing to step up to the plate to accept some change if we're going to move on. And in fact, you might argue that if we don't do something, I was going to ask about the cost of all of this and where we are with our economy right now, but in fact, if we don't do something like this, we're becoming less and less competitive. It's really undermining our whole economic system.
Correct.
We can't keep doing this.
I mean, we're already at a point where healthcare competes with education and other community investments and for competing for dollars, and that's only going to get worse unless the rate of increase of healthcare expenditure can be slowed.
For those of you who are listening who would like to read more and get some really good information, some reliable information, on our website at kska.org/line1, there are two collections of bits of information, one from the Kaiser Family Foundation and one from a large list of editorial comments and perspective pieces at the New England Journal of Medicine that's been going on over a year now that they have collected with valuable information and thoughts about this healthcare system. So I'd like to address that you go to that, and from those places you can find many other links to other bits of information. Let's take another caller at this time. Deborah, you're on line one.
Hello. I was wondering about your perception of the medical community's willingness to participate in reform. If it means something more than adding more people to the insurance pool or simply increasing reimbursement for certain services, even if it's for something as important and valuable as primary care. Does the move away from a fee-for-service payment system to more of a value-based reimbursement system mean that the delivery system will have to be reformed, have to change so that it's more integrated? And do you think our medical community here in Anchorage and in Alaska, all of the individual medical businesses and physician practices are willing and able to work together better to better coordinate care and share in the costs and benefits of a reformed system?
I want our listener or our guest to just realize we've got about 2 minutes to answer the question.
I'll be brief. I think you said this very well. I think the answer to your question is yes, and I hope so.
And my answer is we're going to have to use a mixture of carrots and sticks. There's going to have to be incentives and penalties, because if it's just penalties, we won't get there, and it's just incentives, we won't get there either.
I keep thinking of parenting 101 being a pediatrician. You know, yeah. We get a hell of a lot more if we just reward people yeah. and get slapping them on the hand. We never learn from that. And yeah. And remember that physicians are as different as the public. Yeah. You'd like to think of us all as one in the same, and that ain't true. So I agree. I think there is a consensus among at least the primary care physicians. And I'm saying that only because I'm a primary care physician. I hang around with primary care physicians. I don't know many of the subspecialties, but I think there is a consensus that in primary care that we need change and we need it soon. Thanks for your call, Deborah.
Thank you.
We have one caller. Hang on. I'm afraid we may not have time to do that. I want to stop here and just say, what do we need to do? We got a little over a minute. What again, are the problems? What are some things that we all need to be thinking about to solve this problem?
Go ahead.
Well, I think we need to get a bill out of the Senate. We need to get a bill out of the House. We need to take first steps. After that, we'll still have a lot of work to do.
I agree with that. I think we need a bill. We need it signed by the president this fall. It's going to have a long implementation. Everything Dr. Neubauer said is going to be a slow series of steps. I think most people don't realize all of the bills talk of at least a 5-year implementation plan. There's going to be a lot of work to do.
And it seems from my talking with you two prior to this and my reading is that it's going to take a long time to make all the changes. We're maybe a little bit ahead of where a lot of people thought we would be at this particular time, that there is some consensus coming, but there's a lot more that's going to happen before all of the changes that appear to be needed were going to be implemented. Is that fair to say?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, listen, I wish we had more time. Hopefully we can do this again. Hopefully we're going to make the right changes and some beneficial ones that we'll all take advantage of in this country. So thanks, Dr. Richard Monsiger and Dr. Richard Neubauer, for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Line 1 is going to return next week with Aaron Carroll. He's an associate professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. We'll be discussing his book, Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Health. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, your health connection, is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network and by the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of SAD lights in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.